And the plan had been that the paper would be submitted yesterday and come out, you know, sort of today or tomorrow-ish on AstroPH. But I think we're probably a few days behind that. So, you know, don't tell too many people. But I don't think there's anything too sensitive in here. And people have already talked about this stuff. But what the South Pole Telescope is it's a 10-meter radio telescope, which is shown here, located at the geographic South Pole that we built to go after the Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect and actually do a huge survey to pick up a large number of clusters so that we can constrain dark energy. And of course, if you design a telescope like that, there's a lot of other science that you'll be able to pull out of it. So today I want to talk to you a bit about what the science goals of this instrument are and what we think we'll be able to achieve in the first, you know, well, with our first survey, which is now about halfway over, we're about 2 years into it. And then I also want to tell you a bit about how the whole saga of putting this instrument together. And then I'll actually share with you some of the first results, which are, you know, close to the first blind detection of SZ clusters using millimeter waves.
Is that the main base in the background?
Oh, okay. No, so actually the main base at the South Pole is actually, you know, if you're standing here, it's actually this direction. And it's actually a fairly impressive structure. I mean, my first reaction when I went to the South Pole for the first time was, man, this thing's too big. I won't be able to tell anyone that I'm roughing it. But no, I think this is the Ice Cube drill camp. So Ice Cube's this other experiment that looks for neutrinos, and they basically, you know, have these big drill towers and stuff like that. So you know, I showed you a really pretty picture of the telescope during the day, and you can barely see this, but this is what it looks like most of the time when we're actually observing. And you know, you see sort of the sky up there. Here's the telescope, and it's basically just staring up, and it just follows the sky around for, you know, 6 months a year when the sun's completely down, which is one of the reasons we go to the South Pole. So, you know, when you think of what the South Pole telescope looks like in action, you should think of this, not that pretty shot from the summer. Of course, it's a huge collaboration. These are most of the people that have worked on it. And if you actually ask one to any of these people, I can tell you who they are and like what few year project they did to actually make this thing happen. So I just want to give them all credit. I want to give us, you know, special credit to these four people who are the people that actually wintered over to take our data. So, you know, as you may know, the South Pole gets completely dark for half the year. And during that time, it's so cold, you can't actually fly planes in and out because the hydraulics freeze. And so Zach, who's a grad student from Case, and Steve Caden, the project engineer, actually wintered the first year. And right now, Dana Hrubes and Keith Vanderland are actually down there taking the data, which I'm going to share with you today. So they're complete heroes. Now, in most CMB talks, you know, you start off with something like this, where you basically say that, you know, there's all sorts of exciting stuff that we now know about the universe due to the CMB, you know, whether it's, you know, inflation, which we now have actually some constraints on. From correlations of the EE and TT polarization to, you know, flatness of the universe and then maybe even some dark energy. And then the other thing is that there's sort of two ways where you know, this picture can be fleshed out more with the CMB. One is that there are initial perturbations that are laid down into the CMB that still haven't been exploited in polarization and you know, some still in temperature. And the other thing is that as the photons propagate towards us, they pick up an imprint of from the large-scale structure in the universe, which we can also detect. I decided to try out something kind of cute today. And basically, I made this plot a long time ago because I thought it would just be fun to sort of highlight what we know and what we don't. And the basic idea is that, you know, in the last 10 years, cosmology has, you know, radically changed in the sense that we actually now know what's in the universe and, you know, using some fairly simple equations can trace back the energy density throughout time. So it's pretty perplexing, but right now, 73% of the universe is dark energy. There's a bunch of dark matter, about 23%, and only a little bit of baryons. And then, you know, as you go back in time, you can just sort of solve what the energy density is as a function of scale factor. And, you know, you see things change and all that. The thing I thought was kind of fun about this plot was I color-coded things proportional to poor understanding. So, and the point here is that we know a ton, right? You know, we know that the total energy density adds to one and it's flat, which is really astounding. But then, you know, things aren't done. There's a lot more to be done. The only real energy densities that we understand, I think, fairly completely are baryons, which, you know, occupy this very small amount in this plot. Radiation, of course, when you actually go back to the very early part of the universe, things heat up so much that who knows what's going on. There's all sorts of interesting stuff going on. And then, of course, there's dark matter and dark energy. And, you know, for dark matter, I colored it gray because we understand it gravitationally. For dark energy, we don't even understand that, so I made it even a darker color. And so, if you're building some type of experiment, you'd really like to be able to go after all these dark things because you know there's a lot left to do.
How is dark energy not just cosmological constants?
Oh, it could be, but we don't really know that. There's other possibilities.
How well do we actually know how many of those?
Oh, there's a little wiggle room there, and maybe it breaks up there. This is supposed to be fun.
That's the width of the line.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. You're giving me a lot of credit. Now, it's really, you know, if you just sit down and start thinking through some of the effects that people throw around that you can actually observe with SPT, you can get really excited by looking at a plot like this. There's two sort of main phases for SPT. There's SPT-SZ, which is the first experiment, which is the camera that we have on there right now. And then we're actually working right now to build a polarization camera, which will be able to look at the polarized signals of the CMB. And unfortunately, I don't have that much time to talk about the polarization stuff today, and I really want to focus on the SZ. But there's a couple things we'll be able to get with that. Gravitational lensing, which can sort of help out with a number of things. Specifically, one is neutrino mass, we can pull that out. And then also, we should be able to, if we get the systematics under control, go after inflationary B modes and potentially measure R to 0.01, which is the ratio of the tensor to scalar perturbations that tells you about the energy scale of inflation. That's a hard measurement. But today, I want to talk about the stuff that we already have going underway. The main thing that we're going to go after is the thermal SZ effect, which is an interaction with the CMB photons and galaxy clusters. But as you'll see, when you actually build an experiment to go after that, you'll be able to pick up other things such as, the Heil CMB in the damping tail, which will be able to constrain parameters of inflation, or at least one of them. And then also gravitational lensing, which can, help probe dark matter and other things, as well as the KSZ effect. But I'm going to talk more about this. So what a cluster.
Are you talking about the damping tail? Are you going to talk about that?
I'll talk about that in a few slides.
Because I don't know what damping tail means.
Oh, yeah, no, I'll get to that. Yeah, sorry about that. That was a bit technical. That was sort of an experiment with seeing how that slide went over. So clusters of galaxies, what they are is, obviously they're just a huge conglomeration of galaxies is the first thing. But actually, that's not really a complete picture because 85% of the baryonic matter is actually contained in electrons or actually, an hydrogen that's ionized. But for the purpose of scattering, that seems like electrons. They're really mainly, baryonically, they're mainly a hot gas. And then if you actually look at the total, amount of mass in there, they're actually really more like just a dark matter well that contains this gas that's then falling in there and heating up a lot. And if you actually look at them in X-rays, you see this sort of bright glow that's left over or that's emitted by these, electrons whizzing around. The typical temperatures inside of the clusters are sort of, hundreds of millions of kelvins. So they're just incredibly hot, and that's what you should think of. Now, the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect basically comes about when a CMB photon propagates along, passes through this cluster medium, and about 2% or so of those photons end up getting scattered off the electrons through inverse Compton scattering, and they pick up a little bit of a kick. And so if you actually look at what happens as a function of frequency, you can just take initial black body, which is this red curve, which is what comes off the CMB, and it's 2.7 Kelvin or so, and very accurately a black body. And when these photons get inverse Compton scattered, they pick up just a little energy, which basically shifts this curve to first order a little bit to the to higher energy. And so if you compare the spectrum of this new shifted black body with the initial black body, what you find is that at low frequencies, you get a little bit of a decrement in power, and at high frequencies, you get an increment. And this is a really nice thing because it's a unique spectral signature. Another thing that I should tell you is that it's redshift independent. And the way you can kind of think about that is that the CMB photons are getting redshifted before scattering and also redshifted after, and those two things tend to balance out. And you basically get the same spectral signature, if you're observing a CMB photon later in the universe. And so, what you find is that at frequencies below about 218 gigahertz, you get the decrement, and about above, you get this sort of increment in power. So it gives you a really nice way to actually go out and observe these things. You basically just pick three bands, in this case 90, 150, and 220, and you observe, and you should see a little bit of a dip in temperature at low frequencies and then nothing at high frequency. Yeah?
Good question. The redshift independence, is that
because of the delicate canceling between things, or is it just because the photons are moving?
Yeah, the photons started out at a fixed redshift, basically. So they get redshifted before scattering, and then it's sort of a fractional shift. And so it doesn't really matter where they actually, you know, then they redshift more afterwards.
Okay, so it's in fact it's a fraction shift.
Yeah, right.
So if there's redshift, then you mean that the effect is the same no matter where they scatter.
Exactly, right.
Where they start from.
Right.
No, they all start from.
Yeah, they all start from the same.
Okay, so where they scattering. Okay.
Right. So there's a nice spectral signature, so you can see all the. You get the same effect for a cluster at any redshift.
Does that require thermal photons, or is that? Is that assumed?
Yeah, you can, the CMB is a very, very good black body.
No,
so,
I understand, but I'm just saying, this is too detailed.
Okay.
You actually see deviations from a Pontian spectrum.
Yeah, that's right.
So what magnitude
Let's see. So. I have to be careful because in antenna temperature, also you're talking about a few hundred millikelvin signal out of a 3 Kelvin black body. Yeah, something like that. And the other thing is that the brightness temperature of the cluster is also redshift independent. That's basically related to the same thing. Now. Anyway, this is going to be the effect we're going to use to go out and detect clusters of galaxies. But I want to mention one thing just because it's kind of interesting. There's also another effect which has to do with the bulk flow of these clusters along the line of sight called the kinetic SZ effect. And it doesn't have a unique, its spectral signature is actually degenerate with just the shift in the overall temperature. So if you were to plot it on here, it would look sort of like a bulge. And it could go up or down, and it's about a factor of 5 smaller than this signal. But I just wanted to mention that there's this other SZ signal from bulk flows, just because I may use that later. Now, when you actually go out and look for these things, what you do is, as I said, you build maps in 3 frequencies, and these are simulations of 90 gigahertz, 150 gigahertz, and 220. And if you look at these, you see sort of little black dots in the 90. You can pick up some of them in the 150, although the noise levels are slightly different, and then you don't see much in the 220. And you can apply some type of cluster finder, which is a filter that just looks for dip, nothing, and come up with a catalog of clusters. And the way you actually turn that catalog into cosmology is you then go with some optical instrument and find the redshifts of these guys, which then allows you to plot a histogram of the number of clusters as a function of redshift. And that is the thing that's going to actually contain the cosmology. And the way you can think about this is called cluster abundance, is that there's sort of 2 terms in there. One is sort of the number of clusters as a function of redshift, and then the next one is sort of the volume element and how that's changing with redshift. And this first term is basically a probe of structure growth and the initial spectrum. It's fairly obvious that if you turn on dark energy, you're going to start suppressing growth of structure because you need matter domination to grow things. And then also this volume element change will also obviously depend on dark energy. And here's sort of a little toy model where we've shown a few different, we've basically just varied the W, and you show that the curves can actually shift around. So the name of the game for us is that we want to go out and actually do a survey large enough to get statistics on the cluster count as a function of redshift so that we can then turn it into constraints on dark energy. And if you actually look at what you would want out of an experiment, this is sort of dating back to the proposal, you find that having a 4,000 gray survey with 3 channels at 90, 150, 220, and a very tiny noise of 10 microkelvin per arc minute should allow you to get thousands of clusters, and you'll be able to measure all the clusters that are above the mass threshold of about 2 × 10^14 solar masses. And the really cool thing about this is that since it's redshift independent, you basically get all of them in a given direction above that mass threshold, the good approximation. And if you look at what kind of constraints you can get, and there's sort of some funniness about exactly, there's some sort of internal parameters that you have to worry about. It turns out that we should be able to get sort of a 10% measurement of the dark, or 5% error measurement of the dark energy equation of state, and sort of some added constraints on omega matter. And when you go combine these with other experiments, you'll be able to do even better. And if you look at the the Dark Energy Task Force report, this is sort of getting to be right about the level of a stage three experiment, which is, I think, fairly impressive.
You need to put in the Bermuda spectrum in this, or is it independent?
The primordial spectrum of? So if you had a deeper fluctuations early on, then you'd grow more structure presumably. So that should affect that. So that definitely has to be an ingredient. But the real thing that I think the shape of this thing is also a really important feature, because that's actually what's probing, when matter domination started turning off and going over to dark energy domination. So there's an assumption for sigma 8 in here. And I think, the reason that I say thousands of clusters here rather than I think, in the proposal we wrote, we had sigma 8 closer to 1. We had tens of thousands of clusters. Now it's sort of looking like it's come down. So yeah, that absolutely affects our ability to do this. The current guess is about 0.85. And with that, we'll have thousands of clusters. I think that's really the right scale for what we should be able to do. But yeah, sigma 8 is definitely an ingredient here.
I'm still not clear on whether, are you seeing in those data points, forget the graph, forget the lines, but in the data points themselves, are you seeing the effect of the primordial fluctuations directly, or are you only seeing them? Is it affecting the actual spectrums coming through? It's too small.
It's a total number. It's sort of the overall normalization.
Can you explain that? So the thing you actually measure is you can more or less, you have a temperature you think should be there.
Let me just go back one slide.
What exactly is the algorithm?
Okay, so you basically make maps at three frequencies, and at low frequency you should see a decrement, and then basically the low frequency here is defined as anything below 218 gigahertz, and right around 218 gigahertz. There's a null, and you should see no signal. And so basically what you do is you go out and build these maps, and you basically look for correlated dark spots that are about an arc minute in size between 90 and 150 that don't have a decrement at 220. And so basically the 220 is there to reject the signals that are just sort of CMB fluctuations or something like that. And then once you have those, you then build this cluster catalog of work.
The 220 number came out of the theoretical calculation
So that has to do with how far away the CMB is. Nope. Yeah, the flux. Yeah, there's another slide which I took out in the interest of time, unfortunately, because I want to get into the instrument results, where you basically it just depends on the mass, and that's sort of another really attractive, the mass of the cluster. Yeah, and so basically if you see clusters above a given flux, those all have the same minimum mass. And so it's really nice because then you can actually figure out, in your survey, you have all the clusters above a given mass threshold in that sort of direction in the universe. And then the next thing you need to do before you turn this into science is you need to go out and find out what the redshifts are.
You show those green dots are supposed to be a cluster. And then you go and you look for an object and you
right.
And do you have to find this one object, or do you have to actually find the cluster of galaxies 3?
Yeah, you need to find the cluster of galaxies.
So you find a whole bunch that are in the nearby redshift, and you kind of found one for every one of the green dots.
Well, this is a simulation, but yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah. And then once you do that, then you make a histogram of the number of clusters as a function of redshift, and then.
So sigma 8 came in that logic. It
normalizes the total number of clusters.
Why do you know the total?
It'll just tell you, how good your constraints will be.
He doesn't need to know, just to make the simulation.
Yeah. From the point of view of making that histogram, you didn't need to know the total number.
Yeah. No,
I think you'll get the shape right without that, but you, but
the, they're asking you as a doing the experiment are never going to have to put a sigma in a patient.
Absolutely not.
That was the
question. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was the question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no, no. There's no. There's yeah, no.
Why is an uncertainty in the normalization of that curve? I mean, why? So you, the statistic kind of just coming from your algorithm.
Well no, this is a simulation. This is all simulated. This isn't real data yet. I wouldn't have to worry about it. I just have the histogram, and then that would tell you you'd be able to constrain. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, to make that particular plot.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I'm still sort of in the theory motivation.
Do you look for anisotropies?
There's other stuff you can do with correlations of cluster positions, but I haven't thought carefully about that. But there's definitely other information about clustering of clusters in large structure. But I'll leave it to someone else to give that talk, because I definitely can't right now.
So what kind of constraint can you get in the same way?
I don't think I'm prepared to say that right now. I mean, the way I've thought of doing, the way we've thought about measuring sigma is actually with the power spectrum, which I'll get to in a slide or two. And I know that it can be done, but I don't actually, we'll be able to do I think right now, as I understand it, if you measure the power spectrum, you're limited, the uncertainty on sigma will be limited by theoretical uncertainty and exactly how to do the calculation of what amplitude it should be. I think that's true. So you can write down, based on the signal that we want to go after, what type of instrument you need. And, because the clusters in angular scale are about an arc minute, you need a fairly big telescope, and 150 gigahertz that corresponds to an 8 to 10 meter dish, which is why the SPT looks the way it does. And the real key, though, is that this is a very small signal, and you need to cover a lot of sky to actually do a survey big enough to get the thousands of clusters you need. So you need incredibly low, noise from your receiver. And right now, the state of the art for detectors at 150 gigahertz are bolometers, and they've reached the photon background noise, which is basically to say that from the ground, you're never going to be able to lower their noise anymore. So you can't just build a better detector. And the way you get around this is by just building way more of them. And so the camera that we're going to be looking at is about, 1,000 elements. It's actually 960. And, if you just look at these requirements, this is a hell of an instrument. And there's a lot of other science that you can do with this, and I just want to spend a brief moment talking about a little bit of it. One is the small-scale CMB anisotropy, and I apologize, this is a busy plot, but basically the thing you should look at is that this black curve is the WMAP concordance model, so this is our best guess at what the CMB looks like right now. And then you only need one other horizontal line down here as far as like the theoretical expectation, which is the level of the thermal SZ sort of background, so from undetected sources that you get for a sigma 8 of either 1 or 0.8. And then the rest of the things are either limits from old experiments or the measurements as they stand right now. And so, one thing that you'll be able to do with measurements of the power spectrum is just really nail down what sigma 8 is. And so, I think we're talking about, a few percent measurements, something like that. I mean, I think better than 5, as you'll see in the next slide. But there's a lot of other information here that's also really interesting. For instance, the sort of fall off of this curve tells you, which is called the damping tail, has information about NS and the running of NS, which are two parameters from inflation, which are the sort of primordial power spectrum from inflation. And we should be able to, and right now the constraints on that are coming from sort of this low L part of the spectrum. And when you measure it just there, you have degeneracies with other parameters, such as tau and other things. And so by going to this sort of, if we extend out to much, much higher L, we should be able to really nail that down. And just to give you an idea, I'm not holding it in Zark, this is what we should be able to do with our survey, which, when we have it done, is just kind of mind-blowing, right? I mean, there really won't be much more to do after this. Of course, Planck is going to do similar things on similar timescales, but, we really will have just a huge amount of power to actually constrain these things. So we're going to L of 10,000. So, once you move beyond this, you're going to be going beyond just CMB. You'll be doing all sorts of astrophysics when you do higher angular scales. And in fact, one of the things that we'll have to deal with is point sources, but we should be able to detect them with our own instrument to get rid of them, because those actually cause a spectrum that looks something like that on this plot. And so I just want to show you very quickly how we should be able to do with NS and the running of the index. So these contours right here, this big sort of thing, is what WMAP's constraint is right now. And on here, you can see that they're already getting to the point of being able to sort of rule out some models of the primordial power spectrum, such as Harrison's Zoldovich, which is kind of good news because that way inflation ends. right? But this is what we should be able to do when we combine the measurements we think we should be able to get with WMAP. And you see that there's just this huge shrinking in the error bar. So we may be able, we have the potential here at least to rule out some models of inflation, which I think is a really exciting thing. I think they may only be one sigma. I'm not completely sure. Let me answer that after the talk, because I'm not completely sure. It's been a while since I looked at that. Now, of course, there's a lot of other things that we could go after with this experiment. And there's a couple different ways we can go after gravitational lensing. But one of them, which I think is kind of cool, is that there should be a lensing signal that's generated by the clusters themselves. And so automatically in our data, we will have a catalog of clusters. And so we should be able to just stack up a bunch of them to actually increase the signal to noise. And one of the neat things about that is that should be able to help us calibrate the mass of the clusters, because it gives us an independent measurement of their mass. It goes around, it doesn't involve just flux the SD signal. So it's a nice calibration thing. Another thing that's kind of cool, which I think some people here may be interested in, is that we can actually exploit this kinetic SZ effect, which has to do with the Doppler shifts along the line of sight. And there's a good paper by Montegudo. So I'm completely forgetting, and if he sees on the web, I'll be upset.
Actually, I brought up this in Hernandez
Montegudo. Okay, Hernandez Montegudo. Okay, cool. Good. So I'm giving good credit. Or you're helping me give good credit to the people who did it. But they looked at actually using the thermal SZ effect to figure out where the cluster should be, and then using a noisy estimator for the kinetic SZ effect, which effectively just comes down to asking what's the 220 gigahertz flux of that cluster. So, or what's the flux, the difference between right on the cluster and right next to it. And so that should be an unbiased estimator. And using that, you can then build up, you can then look for correlations in the signal and get extra constraints on dark energy through the bulk flows, which I think is kind of a neat thing. And then, of course, there's all the other astronomy type stuff that we can do that'll fall for free out of the really high resolution deep maps we're going to make, such as, point source surveys to understand what the distribution point sources are, as well as cluster science, such as understanding, what the profile looks like out to way beyond the viral radius. And we're actually already doing that right now. But I think I want to move on and actually talk about, I think there's a huge amount of potential for science, but I want to talk about the instrument that's actually going to get it, which, doesn't live in proposal land. It actually lives in the South Pole. And so I said before, it's a 10-meter radio telescope, and it's completely optimized for doing sub-millimeter observations. One thing you'll notice is that it's an off-axis dish, which just means that the plane wave light comes in through here, gets focused down here, and so there's nothing to block it, which is really good for systematics. So you don't have to worry about diffraction and things like that. Another thing that's really impressive about this telescope is that it's spec to have 1 arc second pointing, which is 1/3600th of a degree. This thing's, I think, 7 stories tall and 600,000 pounds. And it can do a 360 in a minute and a half. So that's pretty scary when it gets away from you, which doesn't happen very often. But no, it happened, or someone thought it happened once, slammed on the emergency brakes, and actually blew out the electric system that stops it. So now we only hit the button if someone's life's in jeopardy. We only had one spare.
And that only if it's a really important person?
No, anyone's. No, I mean, we're in credit. The safety on this project's great, but that's now the rule, not just if you're scared for the instrument. You have to be actually scared for someone, because this thing can act, this thing's designed, this thing, it's 600,000 pounds of steel, and so it can actually slam into its hard stops without any damage to itself. I mean, it's designed to do that, so there's no reason to stop it. There's a lot of fail-safes in it. And then on this telescope, we have a very nice receiver, which I'll tell you about in more slides.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So,
oh, no, it sounds great.
The WMAP isn't a telescope, right?
No, WMAP's a telescope.
It's better.
Yeah, yeah, it's two, two 1 meter.
Sort of
it's a similar design. So WMAP, the scale of WMAP is roughly that. And so there, actually, no, sorry, that's something like that. It's about half of this thing down here. So WMAP, the resolution is just, the resolution of WMAP is sort of, sort of quarter degree, which is about a factor of 15 lower than our resolution. So it's a different instrument. And one question that's often asked is, why do you actually go to the South Pole? And it turns out there's a lot of other reasons beyond just geopolitics for why you're there. And it is really one of the best observing sites for this type of wavelength. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, it's high elevation. Another one is it's extremely dry, which makes it the driest desert in the world. So the precipitation is less than about 2 inches of snow a year. And I think that's a factor of 5 or 10 lower than the Sahara. And if you remember that the way your microwave works is that microwaves are absorbed by water, it's pretty obvious that that's a really big advantage. And then another thing that's really great is that it's, the sun only rises and sets 2 times a year, which means that for most of the season, you can just sort of sit and stare through atmosphere that's not getting turned up by sunrise and sunset. What did you say? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that on the surface or is that in the atmosphere?
No, that's at the surface. That's sort of typical. So it does get down to minus 100, and that's before wind chill. And they actually have something called the 300 Club, where you're supposed to go from the steam room, and this only happens during the winter. And I don't think it's been that cold for 2 winters. And you actually walk around the North or the South Pole, and then come back in. And so it gets really cold. I mean during the summer, it's typically minus 30 or so, although it gets up to zero a couple days. So during the summer months, it's like Canada. In the winter, on a bad day in the winter. It's pretty cold.
So did you join the 300 club?
No, I haven't been down there in the winter. It seems like a bad idea, but if there's not much to do.
It's got 6 months.
Yeah, exactly, I'm sure. I mean, yeah, anyway, I'll tell you more stories at dinner or something when I'm not going out on the web. So I just want to tell you a few more features of the telescope as far as how it addresses some systematic effects such as basically how it controls the radiation, make sure it doesn't go to the wrong place such as the ground. And I think one of the things that's really amazing about this telescope is that light comes in, gets focused down here, and it goes into this, which is a Volkswagen-sized cryosat, which contains our secondary mirror, which is the size of the WMAP primary mirror. So this is sort of about a meter, a little 1.2 meters right there, which then focuses it onto our array. And so if you look at this, any type of stray light from either the focal plane, the first imaging lens, or even the secondary gets trapped, or it just goes straight out onto the primary, where it goes to the sky. And so as far as rejecting the ground and things like that, this is just a great design. Also, it's incredibly simple. I mean, you're talking about two mirrors and a lens, which is much simpler than any camera that we own. And so those are really nice. And if you actually ask how the ground or the pickup or the how well we're actually doing with ground pickup, it's basically just completely not a problem, which is something that just blew my mind because I don't really know of any recent CMB experiment that didn't have to go to some amount of lengths to reject the ground. And I think our design has actually accomplished that. Actually, I just thought of one. What were you saying? Yeah. So the actual baseline design is, and we still have it in there, is that we'll build a ground shield, which will be the largest structure at the South Pole ever. But it's going to require something like, they think they can do it in one summer with 100 full-time employees working on it. And the station population is about 200 people. So given the budget crisis, it's a little bit difficult to move that along. But we still have plans to do it. But the thing that's kind of amazing to me is that so far we've managed to, I think for all the science that I've talked about so far today, the ground won't affect that whatever, or at any level. For doing polarization, I can't swear that we're okay, and so we still have it on the table to build that thing. Now, you know, if you're going to build a 600,000-pound telescope in the confines of about 3 months at the South Pole, you want to make sure that you know how to do it before you go down there. So we actually spent some time in Kilgore, Texas, where it was about 100 degrees. So this thing's been in two really extreme places, putting this thing together and getting it all ready. And we actually went a little farther than this. This is right when we're about finishing up. I just thought it was kind of a pretty picture. And you know, we spent the whole summer building the mirror. The steel guys built this thing, put it together, and then in about a month or 3 weeks, we disassembled it, carted it off to LA, where it got onto a boat, went to New Zealand, and flew to the South Pole in these. And so, you know, if you think of taking your apartment building and fitting into a little plane like that, which, you know, it's a big plane, but it's not that big, it ended up taking, I think, roughly 30 flights. And as a result of that, the telescope is, I think, the most modular telescope that of this size that's ever been built. You know, you'd want to naturally just weld up big pieces of steel and be done with it. But, you know, everything had to fit into this and be less than, I think, I may have the number wrong. I wrote 16,000, but it may have been 26,000 pounds, which is still a, you know, tough limit to get under when you're talking a 600,000-pound object. So those things flew, and then so did we on the same plane. We landed at the South Pole in about, you know, November 15th of 2006. And this is the status of the place where the telescope was going to be built. You can see that the sort of, you know, support structure, but really nothing has actually gone in. And so we just started in earnest putting the whole thing together. And there's some funny logistical things that happen at the South Pole, such as the forklift operators are the least skilled people there. So anything that moves around has a good chance of getting a fork stuck right through it. And so when we were actually putting, you know, we actually decided to assemble the back of the mirror right by the runway. So basically these things would come off the plane and we would just put them together right on this sled right by the runway. And what you're actually looking at is the assembly of the backup structure for the mirror. So basically the mirror is made of a couple different things. It's basically a carbon fiber structure, which is incredibly rigid and doesn't expand or contract, holding a bunch of aluminum panels that actually do the reflecting. And so once we had that all together, we, around November 20th or maybe November 25th, towed it behind this, you know, front loader, which I just think is a really amusing way to get things around. I mean, it just looks so ridiculous, right? And took it over right next to the telescope and started getting ready to put the mirror together. And, you know, here we are sort of putting the first mirror, which is behind Ryan right there. And I think this picture is really funny because when I was a first year in grad school, I actually saw a talk where someone was describing using this, which is a surveying instrument called a theodolite, to put a mirror together. And I thought, my God, that's the most boring thing I've ever heard of. There's no way I want to do that. And then, you know, there I am. But the thing that I found out in between, you know, my first year in grad school and now is that, you know, actually, if the science is really compelling, you'll pretty much do anything. I mean, I'm sure you've done some algebra like that. And so here's the mirror when we're sort of farther along, and you see that there's all these sort of, you know, things here which are adjusters. And so, you know, the game of assembling a mirror like this is basically like tiling your bathroom, where you want to have everything precisely located to about a tenth of a millimeter over, you know, 10 meters. And so, you know, it's a bit of a challenge, but, you know, we basically did it in a couple phases where the first one was to use just surveying tools so that it was really simple. And, you know, when you're dealing with minus 40 degree temperatures, you want to make sure that it's just really simple, robust, and nothing can go wrong, and that it would be close, and then try to fix it later. And so we managed to get about, you know, 2/10 of a millimeter alignment this way. And when we were finally finished assembling it, we were really, really excited. And, you know, I took this fisheye lens picture that makes it look like it's a flat mirror, which is kind of ridiculous, but it was so big I couldn't fit it any other way. And we thought, oh, great, we're finished. Let's celebrate. And then, of course, we looked under the mirror and remembered that there are all these heaters that melt snow off the front that we had to wire up. So we spent a few days doing that. And then, you know, about a week later, we were ready to actually lift the thing on, which was just... No, well, not for me. I mean, I was just really excited, right? So, you know, basically there's the steel crew who are all these guys, who are just great guys, are really fun to hang out with. And they're, you know, to work in an environment like this, you have to have a really good attitude and be incredibly talented. And they, you know, I credit them with building this whole structure in, you know, about a month and a half, which I think is unprecedented, right? And so, you know, the foreman came over, he's like, oh man, I'm so scared. Because, you know, this thing, well, one, it's a two-crane lift, which is a delicate operation because one crane couldn't lift it high enough with the support structure on it. So that's difficult because there's a lot of coordination and all that. And they have to position this thing within about 1/4 of an inch to get it on there. maybe even less, maybe an eighth. And so that was nerve-wracking. Plus, you know, the backup structure is about $1 million. The panels were about $1 million. And so, you know, if anything went wrong, there's no spares. This would completely destroy the project. But I trusted them, and they did a beautiful job. And I got to walk around kind of grinning like this and taking pictures of it. So it was really fun. And at the end of it, you know, we came together and took this picture, so you can get an idea of how big this thing is. And it's just this enormous, enormous thing. You know, so when we were putting together the mirror, we were sort of over here relative to the telescope. And we were in there kind of, you know, tweaking these knobs and making everything really precise. So we were kind of being precision cosmologists. But the steel crew was out there trying to get, you know, beams like that to fit onto the telescope. So they'd be out there swinging a sledgehammer, just making these huge percussive noises. And so we were kind of making the joke that they were the percussion cosmologists. So we came together and just took this picture. And, you know, it was a blast working with them. And we were really proud of ourselves. Of course, the telescope by itself doesn't do any science. And I have more stories to tell. So. You know, once you get this thing together, you think, okay, great, great, we're really done. But then you still actually have to make the surface better. And actually, that lift is a fairly violent act and actually distorts it a bit. And so we used a couple techniques, the first of which is called photogrammetry, where you see all these black targets on there, and there's actually a bunch more that you can't see. It's really neat. There's actually this commercial software. You just take pictures of something that has these little reflective stickers on it from all over the place. You can dump that into a computer program that figures out where the camera was and where all the targets are to about 20 or to about 50 micron accuracy. And so we used that. Yeah, exactly, right? And so we used that, and, you know, I climbed around on the back of this thing, turned, you know, the 1,000 volts a bunch of times, and managed to get to about 50 microns. But we wanted to get to 25, and that required a better technique. And so there's got to be a joke here. We used holography. And, like, I feel like, you know, in this institute where you guys, you know, use holography for different purposes in a slightly different way, there's got to be some joke, but I couldn't quite figure it out. But, you know, it's kind of a neat measurement. Basically, you just point your telescope at a source, which here is on this very thin tower you can't see. But there's a little kind of dot up there, which is the, you know, where the source is on the tower. sort of. Yeah, no, it's an 88 or 86 point something gigahertz microwave source. It's a little thing called a gun oscillator, which is named after some guy named G-U-N-N, not a gun. But, you know, exactly right. And so it's kind of a cute measurement. Basically, you know, if you calculate what the diffraction pattern of something is, if you know that the fields on the aperture sort of right after you leave the telescope, you can calculate what the diffraction pattern is anywhere. And so what you do is you go out and you actually measure the diffraction pattern. And then you invert this equation and you're left with the fields on the aperture. And if the telescope were perfect, you can, you know, what's a parabola do? It actually focuses, you know, outgoing spherical wave at its focus into a plane wave. And so you'd have constant aperture or phase across that aperture. So anything you see is actually a measurement of the errors in your mirror surface. And here's actually the final alignment of the mirror, which is at 25 microns. And you can actually see the individual panels, which I think is just, I mean, kind of, I think it's kind of amazing that we could actually pull this off, especially in like a 6-week time period. Yeah, right. Now, of course, the other sort of, you know, major component of the instrument is the camera, which is shown right here. And notice it kind of has a round snout and is sort of square like a camera should be. I mean, it's sort of a joke, right? I mean, just cameras look that way when you have them at home. But this one's a very, very fancy one. It contains about 1,000 elements. Here's Brad actually assembling them. And this is our focal plane. I'll describe more about the technology in a bit. And then when we were done with that, we basically just mounted on our Volkswagen-sized optics cryostat and placed it up into the telescope. But, you know, the technology we use for the camera is so-called TES bolometers. And a bolometer is basically just a little thermometer, and you just absorb the radiation onto it and see how much it heats up. And that's actually the state of the art for doing measurements at these frequencies. What a TES is that you make the thermometer out of a superconductor that's held right in its transition, so between superconducting and normal. You see that there's a huge change in the resistance for a very small change in its temperature. So it's a very nice way to get good sensitivity. And the other real advance is that you voltage bias it. And what that means is that if it heats up, the resistance goes down, which means that it basically stays, which is a way to give negative feedback and actually hold it at the same operating point. And you can kind of tell there's a little bit of curvature to this curve. So if you want to make sure that thing's completely linear, you want to hold it near the same operating point. And so that's a way to get a really nice, stable, state-of-the-art detector. And you know, the real advance here is that we made a bunch of them. And I'm just sort of going in order through this thing. Here's the actual TES, which is this tiny thing, which is heat sunk to this very big absorbing grid. And then the key to actually getting sensitivity we need is to build about, you know, 1,000 of them. So we build them 160 elements to a wedge and assemble them into this camera where we have, you know, different bands and different wedges. So we have, this year we have three that are 150 gigahertz, two that are at 220, and one that's at 90. And, you know, here's Brad Benson, who's a postdoc now at Chicago, who is at Berkeley, holding, you know, the somewhat finished thing. You can tell he's really excited because, you know, when we first put this thing on the telescope, it was by far the most sensitive camera for these frequencies that had ever been done. And then, of course, we had to lift the camera up into the telescope to actually make it work. And one of the things that, that people have learned by working at the South Pole is that you just never want to have to go outside. And so basically, we have this way of docking the telescope, which, you know, this is sort of the lower boom where the secondary sits, with the building. And then the, sort of this kind of door descends. We open a hatch, and then you can basically just have full access up there. And we just hoisted it up. And then at that point, we were really ready to observe.
What was it that tuned the different sections of the camera to different frequencies?
Oh, okay. So that's a really good question. So there's a couple things, something I haven't told you, just because I was really just skipping over stuff, is that we actually have feed horns that go in front of each element, and you can basically tune the waveguide cutoff by just opening up the diameter. So that's actually what provides the high pass filter, and then in front of it, you can see these sort of gold things. These are actually just capacitively tuned metal mesh filters, which provide a high pass, those are the low pass. The other is the high pass. Got it backwards. And you know, then there's a few other things that we do, such as there's a back short behind the absorbing web, and we tune that distance to make them, you know, more absorbing in frequency. There's a number of games.
How accurate is that?
For what?
Well, you want to measure 90.
So the key is that you need to know exactly what it is, and so, you know, if we're off by a few, you know, I think we're typically hitting about 5 gigahertz, but you know, you need to know what that is, and so that's a calibration problem. So, you know, especially for you need to know what the band center and width is, and you know, also if there's a slope through it and things like that. And you know, where that really comes in most, or where you're most sensitive to it, is at 220 if you're trying to do kinetic SZ work. Because then, if you're off the null, you'll see a signal every time, and so you know we're working on that. That's a good question. And so at this point, we're ready to observe, and I just want to emphasize that, you know, basically everything I've shown you so far went from about November 20th to about February 17th, which, you know, when you think of building an apartment complex, it usually takes a year. And this one, you know, is basically about that scale, but it can point anywhere on the sky, is high precision, and contains one of the world's best cameras. And that camera, you know, was assembled in basically a month and a half. And, you know, we managed to commission this thing and get first light on February 16th, right before the station closed for the year, so we could actually leave a working instrument. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever, you know, seen one of these things go together firsthand, but there was a lot of ups and downs when we thought this is over, there's no way we're going to do it. And, you know, we managed to pull it off. And yeah, I'm just really, really proud of this time scale.
Why did it shut down? Is it just getting too cold?
Well, so what happens is the planes can't fly in and out of the South Pole when it drops below about minus 50 because the hydraulics freeze. And so the landing gear, I think, fails. So there's no flights for 9 months.
So was that a hard deadline? Was it 17th?
We actually got them to let us have a one-time waiver and stay an extra 8 hours. And John Carlstrom's, it's really, really hard. I mean, there's actually a story of someone, oh man, I'm really running over time. This is awful.
Well, I mean, I think it's okay. No one needs to leave the camp, but I think everyone's
okay, cool. I've horribly managed my time. Anyway, this is the people that actually made all this stuff happen the first year. And I really want to get in to tell you about what happened since then, because basically this is February 2007. And since then, the story's actually continued, where we have a full season of observations, did some improvements on the telescope, and then observed again for another season. So we have quite a lot of really good data. Now, if you look down at the South Pole, you know, basically you're directly under here, and so you can only see the sky that's above, you know, the southern galactic sky or southern celestial sphere. Additionally, the galaxy sort of has a lot of emission over on this half, so that's out. And you don't want to look too close to the ground because then you're looking through too much of atmosphere. So basically, there's one 4,000 square degree region that we can really observe, and so that's really where our ultimate survey goal will be. But within that, there's a couple of really interesting regions, which are these green curves. You know, I mentioned before that you need optical follow-ups to actually turn the SZ data into, you know, constraints on cosmology. And there's this thing called the Blanco Cosmology Survey, and they've surveyed about a total of 100 square degrees between two fields, which is already done. And so we chose those as for our initial survey. And during the first year, we basically observed this one, and the instrument worked fairly well. We managed to get about, you know, 400 kilometers up a night, and using those, we were able to survey 60 square degrees down to about 40 microkelvin for arc minute, dominantly with 90 gigahertz and 150 gigahertz channels. 220 wasn't working so well, and, you know, just to prove it was working, we managed to measure a cluster in about an hour and get a 5-sigma detection. And just to compare, with previous instruments, you would have spent a month or more doing this, and that would have been a paper, and this was just sort of our proof of concept. So that was really exciting. But the noise was slightly higher than we expected, so we wanted to go down and fix it after that season. And so we went down and completely rebuilt the camera. And, you know, just to give you some idea of how much better we're doing now, here's the same cluster in 40 minutes instead of an hour, and we've made the map with only the 150 gigahertz channels instead of the 150 and 90, and it's now at 16 sigma. So, I mean, it was a dramatic change. We're within about a factor of two of what we hoped to be in the proposal, which, if you've read a CMB proposal, is actually quite good. but I want to kind of move through this a little bit faster now. So at this point, we've covered 100 square degree patches over these two fields with our new improved focal plane. And we basically have each of those 100 square degree patches down to 15 microkelvin per arc minute, which is a mind-blowing sensitivity if you have looked at CMB data before. And I'll just kind of, I think I'm just going to sort of fast forward through how we actually do the data analysis, because as I say on this slide, it's basically simple. You basically build a map. In that map, to do that, you actually just calibrate the detectors, make sure they have roughly the same gain, co-add them, and bin them up, and then you start looking for clusters. I'm just going to skip to the part where we actually have maps, because I think you're going to be blown away. So this is one of the BCS fields, and this outline here shows where the BCS coverage is. And then this red sort of contour plot is our data. And when I first made a map using some of this data, I saw these kind of low frequency wiggles, and I thought I'd done something wrong or something, the instrument was broken. And after a few days worth of work, I managed to realize that it's CMB. And so, you know, this is a direct image of, you know, the fine scale CMB. And you can see that this is sort of a 10 by 10 patch. So, you know, the scale you're sort of picking out is about, you know, half degree or quarter degree, which is about, you know, about what you'd expect. And then, of course, there's a bunch of other things in here, such as little bright point sources, but I'll show you those more when we zoom in on it a bit in a bit. But just to give you an idea of how clean this data is, you can do a study where you basically difference halves of your data against each other to basically make sure that this signal goes away. And so the way this is actually observed is we scan left, right, go up a little bit, scan again, and just keep doing this as the sky is tracking. And if you take the left minus the right instead of summing it, you get this, where most of the signal goes away. And you still do see some things, but it turns out that our instrument has a bit of 1/f noise. And so this level of differencing is actually consistent with noise when you actually go through and look at what it looks like in power spectrum space. Of course, we played the same game with the second field. And so, you know, the punchline is that we have a huge, amazing data set. And it'd be really exciting to push forward and do a whole lot of analyses on these. And, you know, just to give you an idea, because, you know, once you're seeing the CMB, you kind of wonder what the power spectrum is going to look like. This is the forecast of what we'll get from one of those 100 square degree patches. And so you can see that, you know, if we bin some things together, we should already be able to do a tight constraint on sigma 8. And again, I forget what the second one is for, but we should be able to, you know, measure it better than 10%, I would guess. And we should be able to start actually pushing into a lot of CMB topics. But the main thing I want to talk about today is actually going after the clusters, because, you know, that's the results that I get to share with you. And so when you look in these maps, you see that the dominant thing you see is the CMB. Then next thing you see is these point sources. And then if you look very carefully, you can see a bunch of things that look like little dark spots. And those are the actual cluster signals. But we need a way to actually go through and clean out all the stuff we don't want. And the technique we use is called match filtering, which is just incredibly simpler, incredibly simple. You basically just apply, oh, go ahead.
Dark because of the
SD
effect?
Yeah, the SD effect.
Why is it darker? Because
so it's a so remember I showed that below about 218 gigahertz you get a decrement. And so the reason so you might look at this and say, aha, there's a giant cluster, except that's just the CMB fluctuation. So there's sort of two things that allow you to figure out the clusters. One is angular scale. They're sort of about the scale of a beam. And so you're looking for very small dots that have a good contrast with the stuff right around them. And so, you know, this guy looks like it's fairly plausible. And there's a few other things in there. But, you know, when you're looking at it with no filtering, you see these other astrophysical signature or, you know, signals as the dominant contribution. And so what we're going to do is just filter all that out and then just be left with these maps that show where the clusters are. And they'll be booming. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's also hard to have a negative point source. I'm pausing for a second because you can imagine some things where you have a bunch of point sources that have a ring, but you know it's a little bit unlikely. But I'll show you some of the clusters we've detected and make arguments as to why they're real. So the technique we use is called match filtering. Basically, what you do is you come up with a noise model and you know a signal template. In this case, the signal template is going to be roughly things that look like a Gaussian, so things that are beam scale. And the noise will include not only instrumental noise, but also the CMB and point sources. And I'm just going to go through this fairly fast because I don't think it'll affect the punchline. There's a couple choices. We've changed what the different filters are, and it doesn't really affect things. And just to give you an idea of what this filter does, if you take this sort of raw image and apply a match filter to it, you'll end up getting this dot that basically is consistent with a 12 sigma detection. And you can play the same game with different things. And over here, you even see a positive point source of some type. And you see that really only the very, very significant cluster type signal comes out. And you know, you can play games by changing the properties of the filter. And you know, the point is, as you vary these things, you still get a detection. So you know, the results that we get with these filters are fairly stable. And now I just want to get to the results. These are our first four cluster candidates that were selected with SPT. Each column represents a different cluster. And the different rows represent different maps. So we did all these detections using our 150 gigahertz channel because it's our most sensitive. And what you see is you get this very significant detection in each of these four that ranges from about 8 sigma down to about 5.5. So basically, they're ordered in brightness. And you know, when you see these, you know, the first thing you want to do is make sure that these are real. And one thing you can do is look back in your maps that are unfiltered to make sure that it kind of looks reasonable. And so here's a map of 150 with less filtering. You see that the clusters are fairly obvious. This one, you might be a little concerned that there's this other CMB fluctuation around there, but I'll get to why that's not a worry. Now, there's two things you can do to check. One, to rule out the idea that there are CMB fluctuations, you can check the 220 gigahertz channel and make sure there's nothing there. And so if you go down to this row, this is the 220 gigahertz channel for the same region, and you'll notice that you don't see anything. And if you actually ask what the significance in the center of these maps is, it's less than a sigma. So there's really no evidence, you know, so there's a spectral dependence that we've measured. The kinetic SZ is typically a you know factor of 8 or so smaller than the regular SZ, so we wouldn't see it. What did you say? Okay, so this was about 8 sigma down to about 5.5. And then I forget the exact significance of the 220 gigahertz non-detection, but I think this is 1.1 sigma is the highest one, and the rest are all sort of, you know, much below one sigma. So it's very encouraging that we don't see anything here. Another thing that is encouraging is that our 90 gigahertz channel, which should also see the decrement, but is somewhat more noisy, you can apply the same match filter and then ask what significance you detect. And you find that at 90 gigahertz, you get ranging from about 3.5 down to about 2.6 or 2.7 sigma. And so you can ask the probability of whether this would happen at random. And it ends up being that our worst cluster is like 98% confirmed by the 90 gigahertz channel. So basically, we detect them at 150. 90, supports that there are detections of SZ, and 220 supports their detections, that they have the right spectral signature. And so this is a really exciting data set, because I think this is the first time that people have been able to use the SZ effect to detect clusters where they didn't know where to look. So this is the first blind search for SZ clusters, and a very positive step towards actually doing the cosmology.
Are you subtracting the binary anisotropy using
No, we're just filtering it out. So it's basically an angular. So by the time you.
The primary anisotropy on your angular scale would be much smaller than the SZ signal. I thought you'd be worried about large angular scale anisotropy.
Right. You're absolutely right that the CMB power spectrum is dying off by the time you're getting these angular scales. But, And when you look in these maps, you can still see that the dominant thing is not the CMB. The sort of CMB fluctuations are sort of on the background of this thing.
Right.
And this is over a 40 arc second, maybe 28 arc second scale. And that, the dominant signal is coming from the cluster. So that there's not,
right.
So it's not a CMB type thing. Or so, yeah, so the CMB is not, is at a different angular scale. No, it's just a pure, it's basically a high pass filter.
What's the main source of the noise?
Instrument noise.
Also, why didn't there's an enhancement at higher frequencies. You don't have the data for that?
Yeah, we don't have those frequency bands. It turns out that higher frequency data, it's harder to look through the atmosphere. So it's actually easier to get a lot, high quality maps at lower frequency just because of atmospheric stability. But so hopefully you guys are impressed that we actually have these detections, because this is a really, very impressive step forward towards these SZ surveys. And we've done some work to actually look. Well, we did a literature search to find out if any of these clusters had been discovered before, and it's actually quite reassuring that the first one had by Rosat. So it was seen in the X-ray, and then you can ask the question: where do we detect it versus where they detect it? And so our detection is actually this X, or this plus. Their detection is at this X. And you can plot our lightly filtered map underneath this, which is what we've done. And you remember that our cluster detection algorithm assumes radial symmetry. And so we'll detect some weighted mean as the central position, which is what we do. But when you actually look at the flux that we're getting in a lightly filtered map, you see that it's much brighter right where the X-weighted detection is, which makes a lot of sense because X-ray is proportional to the electron density squared, where so they would just strongly see almost all their emission coming from there. So that's incredibly encouraging. Angular scale? It's less than an arc minute, like a quarter arc minute or something like that. I don't remember exactly. Well, actually, let's see. I think it's a half arc minute. It looks like a half arc minute. We're working on that. We're not ready to say that.
But in general, like how good are you at estimating masses of the cluster?
That's one of the outstanding topics. I mean, so right now we're at the point of releasing SC detections, and we're confident that those are detections. But actually, understanding all the details to make sure we understand the mass limit is sort of what we're starting to work on right now as we finish up the paper, so that we can then get on to the cosmology. So this is sort of a preliminary result, just showing that the technique works and that we're ready to press forward. But pressing forward, I said in a few slides ago that the analysis is very easy, but actually knowing all the details and keeping track to make sure that you understand exactly what's happening to the signal at each point requires a lot of care. And so we're going to have to go back and revisit that a lot. So we're not really ready to say that yet.
That makes sense. If you want to publish the first SC discoveries.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
Before
right, exactly. and we've gone through and we've actually taken the BCS data. So I didn't mention this before, but we only took the four clusters I showed you were the four most significant clusters in the overlap of one of our fields with the BCS data. So there's already pre-existing optical data for those clusters. And here it is. And you may be thinking, wow, that looks very complicated. But let me just show you a few things that are really encouraging. So I already told you about how this cluster was a previously known X-ray cluster, so we won't worry about that right now. But one thing that is, you may have to squint a little bit at this. I know I did. You may notice there's this sort of blue arc here and a blue arc there. And those are gravitational lensing, strong gravitational lensing of some background galaxy. So that implies that there's a lot of mass here, which is a really encouraging sign. Additionally, if they're clusters, you should be able to see a few different characteristic things. One is that since a cluster of galaxies all share the same redshift, you should be able to see a bunch of things that are about the same color. And you see there's a number of red things here. And you see a number of red things over here, too. And also, there's another gravitational lens happening right there. So basically, the thing I want to, oh, and one more thing that happens with clusters is you get a very bright central galaxy, basically because there's a power law distribution in the masses of these galaxies. And you just end up having one that's very, very bright. And you can see that for these two guys, too. So the point I want you to want to make with this is just that we have the optical redshift. We're working on it, and we're working to get redshifts. And currently, we think this guy's at about 0.4, and I'm going to forget which of the three are which, but we basically think the rest are like 0.6 and 0.8 and around 0.8. And there's some sort of big uncertainties on that, but the point is that we, in other wavelengths, with expert eyes that look at these, such as Joe Moore, he assures us these are all, smoking gun cluster candidates. So, yeah, I'm a physicist looking at optical data, so it's a little bit hard for me to make the same claims, but I'm very encouraged.
You can't just scan through the data and find clusters just without knowing where to start.
So you can do it, and people are working on it, but it starts getting harder as they get more and more distant, which is one place where we really shine. And then also if there's two clusters that are, you can just look at this and see that it's a really clean way to detect clusters using the SZ.
Yeah.
but I think people are working on improving their algorithms, and it'll be really good to kind of compare between different things and do all that stuff.
And the reason that only one of them was discovered in X-ray is that because of
redshift. Redshift, yeah. So with X-rays, there's a big cosmological dimming. As they get farther away, you just can't see them at all. And that's really one of the reasons that SZ is great. So I just want to leave you by saying that hopefully I've convinced you we're an exciting tool for cosmology with a lot of potential for a lot of exciting science in the very near future, and that we have data and that we're far along in actually doing some of this science, and that we're nearing the end of our second season, and with the data we already have in hand that we just took in the last 6 months, we've detected the first clusters using the SZ effect, and we're poised to do a lot more. I think it's right here. Yeah, so this is Ice Cube. I'm sorry. Here it is. It's right here. It's just this screen's so low resolution I couldn't see it. Just to give you a tour. Here's the new station, which is this giant thing over there. This is the old, where Quad is and where Daisy is. This is where there are two other CMB experiments. Quad is a thing that Clem Pryke just talked about a few weeks ago. This is BICEP, which is a thing out of Caltech. And here's SPT, and you can almost make it out. It's a little tough.
Where's the actual pole?
The pole is right. It's right here. Yep.
South Pole.
Yeah.
The South Pole is there.
Yeah, the South Pole. South Pole telescope.
Yeah,
no. It's literally It's the telescope. I mean, it's a kilometer away from the South Pole.
Well, then that's
and then, you know, the walk to work basically consists of crossing the landing strip, and sometimes you have to wait for planes. Yep.
Yeah, what territory is that?
International. Only for science.
Right, but there's, I know that there's claims. This is all trivia.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we'll talk about it over dinner or something. So I think, you know, we have the data for that, and we're working towards it. But I think there's a number of things that have to be done. You know, with that, I think we just want to make sure we understand our noise really well, and you have to work harder on the noise model, and understand what our filtering is doing to affect the spectrum. And we're working towards that. But you know, I don't want to give out an exact time period. But
you're right.
Yeah. I think you can expect something in the next year, conservatively.
For the election.
Oh, not this calendar year. That'd be really great.
About the lensing?
So I think the first lensing signal will be that we'll try to pull out. So I'm not an expert in this, but our Berkeley collaborators have been thinking about it. And there's a signal you can get where you basically look at the, you know, higher order correlations than the power spectrum, to try to reconstruct sort of the lensing mass power spectrum out of that. And that looks like we can do that with our 100 square degree survey. But you know, once you see higher you know, order correlations, my guess is it'll take a little longer. But in principle, it's there.
For comparison, what's the story with
Planck? Planck should launch at the end of this year. And so then they have a 2-year observing campaign, and so they should be able to produce some very, very nice power spectra rapidly, because I think their analysis is very, very far along. But you know, I think we should definitely ask someone in the collaboration. But when I talked to Martin White, he was saying that their plan was to release a whole slew of papers all at once. So my guess is that means that they'll take slightly longer to get it all out, but I think there's also my impression is there's an active debate going on in the collaboration. There's a good chance they may produce the easy things first, you know, right away, and then sort of work their way to all the other stuff. And so I think they should have their data in about, you know, they'll have all the data they'll get in about 2 years or 3 years. And, you know, the analysis will be sort of ongoing through that period, I would guess. And then, you know, also I should mention our collaborators in Chile with ACT, who are also doing very similar science and are, I think, at a very similar state. So it should be a really exciting next couple of years for cosmology.